This is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer Frank Verderosa. Our guest this week is a singer, guitarist, recording artist, manager, Grammy-winning record producer, and eyewitness to some of the most important and defining musical events of the last half century. As one half of the British pop duo Peter and Gordon, he scored 9 top 20 hits, including I Go to Pieces, Lady Godiva, and the million-selling number one single World Without Love, penned by his longtime friend Paul McCartney. After splitting up with partner Gordon Waller in 1968, he went on to scout and develop new talent for the Beatles' Apple Records label, discovering and signing a 20-something songwriter named James Taylor. He produced over a dozen Grammy-winning recordings and worked with artists such as Linda Ronstadt, Neil Diamond, Diana Ross, Elton John, Randy Newman, Ringo Starr, Billy Joel, Bonnie Raitt, and even Steve Martin and Robin Williams, and is responsible for such hits as Fire and Rain, You've Got a Friend, Shower the People, You're No Good, When Will I Be Loved, and It's So Easy, to just name a few. You want more? He's also a former child actor, a member of Mensa, and the first person to ever hear I Wanna Hold Your Hand when a young Paul McCartney and John Lennon played it for him in the basement of his mother's house. Wow. Please welcome a man of multiple talents and our first guest to be appointed a commander of the British Empire, the legendary Peter Asher.
Wow, what an intro. I should take you with me everywhere. Thank you very much. That's amazing. It's like a whole opening act.
That's it.
Now, thank you.
Now, before anything else,
yes, sir.
Your grandfather was Lawrence of Arabia's lawyer?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, wow.
He was also an amateur playwright and a musician, but he was a solicitor, and one of his clients was Lawrence of Arabia. It is true.
Fantastic.
And did he go to his office on a camel?
No, I don't think so. Yes. No, but he did show up. My mother met him when she was little.
Wow, your mother met T.E. Lawrence.
My mother met T.E. Lawrence. She was around 17 or so, and she did tell her father how incredibly handsome she thought he was, and there was a way, and she couldn't remember exactly how he told her, but he made it clear that that was not what he was interested in, that an attractive young 18-year-old woman was not what Lawrence was looking for in life. And I've always wondered what exactly how you explained it back then, because you didn't go, oh, he's gay, that's for sure.
Oh!
But she was apparently tactfully informed by her father that not to get her hopes up.
Wow.
I just keep seeing Peter O'Toole in my head.
Of course, because we don't really know the real T.E. Lawrence looks like. We could look it up, but most people...
No, he was handsome. He was extremely handsome.
He was handsome.
There's photos. He was very handsome and in captain's uniform and everything. But.
Right.
And the other thing is, if anyone listening out there looks up the name Peter Asher, early photos, and looks on YouTube for one of his earlier performances... You were Austin Powers.
Well, no, not really. But what is apparently the case, and what Mike Myers has confirmed, is that there were some photos of me back in that era that definitely informed the look of Austin Powers to a considerable degree. Because I did have the bad teeth and the square black glasses that I was copying Buddy Holly and so on. There's a thing that... TMZ did, where they actually lined up some photos of me and Austin Powers to make the point, which do look remarkable. As they put it, the poor guy really did look like Austin Powers. But the character was not based on me. I think it was based on a DJ called Simon Day, I think, and a few other people. So, you know, not that I wasn't Shagadelic, I'm sure, but I was not the role model, but I was apparently to some degree the visual inspiration for the look.
Did you ever talk to Mike Myers about it?
I did once. Yeah. I mentioned it to him, and he kind of nodded. Yeah,
that's fun.
Yeah, because when I look at those photos, it's scary.
No, it is. He definitely. There was one particular picture, you know, where you can really see that he kind of went, well, maybe he should have that look, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Before we get into Peter and Gordon, I want to talk, you brought your mom up, and I mentioned to Gilbert just before we turned the mics on that your mom, you not only come from a musical family, but your mom was a teacher. She was in the London Philharmonic.
She was a professional musician. She played in various orchestras, in the Halle Orchestra for a while, and for Sir Thomas Beecham, and I'm not sure which other ones. And then she was Ober Professor at the Royal Academy of Music in London, yes, and also taught privately, taught at the academy and gave some private lessons.
And did she teach George Martin? Do I have that right?
That's one of the strange coincidences. Yeah,
wow.
By the time I met George Martin in a completely other context, he went to the Guildhall School of Music where she was a guest professor, and he was one of her pupils, yes. He was an oboe player.
And here's a question I always ask people who knew George Martin. Do you think the Beatles could have made it as big as they did without George Martin?
I don't know about as big, but the Beatles would have made it whatever. They were that good.
Yes.
I mean, there is a level of talent that is undeniable and unstoppable, in my view, that whatever happens, it would have made its mark on the world. Did George help the Beatles' records be even better than they would have been otherwise? Absolutely, yes. Does the genius of their records owe George a huge debt of gratitude? Absolutely, yes. Is he one of the best record producers in the world? Yes. Would the Beatles have happened without him? Probably yes, but it might have been different. You know, it's hard to say. You know,
yeah.
But in the same way, people have asked me that question about James Taylor. You know, what would he have made it? And the answer is yes, absolutely. You know, so it's not.
Well, you certainly helped.
But I helped. Exactly. I was proud to help. But I mean, I was just amazed when I heard him and went, you know, you're colossally good. You know, this is insane. You know, you actually get to the point where you can't believe nobody else has gone, this guy's brilliant, and signed him up and made a record. I just happened to be there first. And George was the first person to hear how good the Beatles were and recognize it.
I love that George also worked with comedians, that he worked with the Goons.
Absolutely.
He had that background.
That's one of the things that recommended him to them and to me. I mean, the reason we all knew George Martin was cool wasn't the music records he'd made thus far.
Yeah.
It was the fact that he produced Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers, who were our heroes.
Sure. I saw an interview with you, and you said it all comes back to Spike Milligan.
It does.
which I love.
British humor entirely goes back to Spike Milligan. Okay. And he's not that well known here, but he's, of course, a hero to all of us, to Monty Python and to all the comedians who came after.
And the Beatles,
tell
too.
Us
and
how,
the Beatles.
Tell us how you made the connection with Paul McCartney.
Oh, well, that's I can't take the credit for that. But what happened was my sister, you know, was and is a successful actress in England. And
Jane Asher.
And she was kind of a celebrity and still is. And it was in that context, I think, that she was invited to go and see this band. It was the Radio Times who invited it, which is a kind of like our TV guide, except we didn't really need a TV guide because we only had one television station, which was the BBC, which was only on a night. But anyway, so this was for radio programs. And they were doing an article on the Beatles, and they asked her to go and see them and kind of do a review. So she went to see them in London and met them after the show. You know, she thought the band was incredibly good. She met them afterwards, thought they were funny and cute and charming and everything. And she liked them, they liked her. One of them liked her in particular and asked her out and so on. So she ended up going out with Paul McCartney for a few years. And it was in that context that I met him. And because shortly after that, you know, one of the functions of that relationship was that he was hanging around our house all the time. And eventually our parents kind of took pity on him and offered him the guest room at the top of the house when they weren't out on the road. And so he moved in, and he and I shared the top floor of the house, and that, you know, we ended up becoming friends.
And one time he invited you to listen to a song he wrote.
Yes, there was in the basement of the house was a small music room where my mother would give private oboe lessons occasionally, but not very often. So she had said to Paul, if you ever need to use a piano, because he plays piano very well, he's one of those people who can play everything very well. And she said, if you need a piano, use the one in the basement music room. So John came over one day, quite soon after he'd moved in. This was early on. And they were down there for a couple of hours, interestingly, with no guitars. The guitars were up in his bedroom and my bedroom on the top floor. And they were down there for a couple of hours. There was a small upright piano and a little sofa and a music stand. It was a tiny room. And then Paul called up the stairs and asked if I wanted to come down and hear the song that they had written. So I came down and sat on the little sofa, and they sat side by side on the piano bench and played I Want to Hold Your Hand for the first time. Freshly minted.
Wow.
And asked me what I thought.
So you were like the first person in the world to hear I Want to Hold Your Hand.
He was.
Other than the composers, yes.
Yes.
Did you have an ability at that tender age to recognize a hit song?
I think we all would have. I mean, you kind of go, am I losing my mind, or is this one of the best songs I've ever heard in my life? And of course, what you really do, which is what I did, is ask them to play it again.
And they did.
Because that's what makes, you know, we all know, it's like when you used to buy 45s, and the minute the needle got to the big old fat grooves in the middle, you'd yank it back to the beginning. Oh. Because that's the great thing about a hit record. You just want to hear it again and again.
I miss those days.
Yeah.
Didn't he also write Yesterday in the House, and you weren't home at the time?
That's right. Yeah. He did. I think my mom was the first person to hear that. But
wow.
You probably know the story, but he woke up with the melody completely formed in his head and was convinced it was an existing song. He wasn't going around saying, listen to this song I've written. He was going around saying, what is this? You know, he sang it to my mom and to various people saying, you know, this must be something. It's melody stuck in my head. And eventually, by process of elimination, he realized he'd written it inadvertently.
And did he originally call it Scrambled Eggs?
It originally had no lyrics. And then they were looking at some point, as I say, I wasn't there, so I didn't witness this, but at some point during that day, the temporary lyrics, that he was looking for a da-da-da, you know, and the first da-da-da that apparently came to mind was Scrambled Eggs. So at one point, it was something about Scrambled Eggs, How I Love Your Legs or something.
Yeah, but it's fascinating. His initial reaction was, someone must have written this. This must exist.
It's the only tune, apparently, where he woke up with it completely done as a melody.
I love that.
But, I mean, nobody knows really where songs come from. That people tend to get a bit mystical about it. But that was an extreme case, to wake up with one of the best songs ever written, pre-written, without having to make any effort.
Of course.
We should all be so lucky.
Oh, what an ability.
And you're a member of Mensa?
It's true. Well, I took the test.
We don't go in any order here, Peter, as you can see.
I took the test a very long time ago, so at least they don't make you retake it. You know, there's no readmission qualification.
I'm sure in 150 guests, we've never had a Mensa member in here before.
I wonder. I probably did it when, you know, I probably took it when I was about 16. So, you know, but I've worked on my brain cells pretty vigorously since then. So who knows what's left? You know, but luckily, they don't make you recheck your IQ.
Gil, you're not in Mensa?
No, it's so political.
But I do like those kind of logic things. I mean, I read philosophy at university and that kind. So I do like, maths and logic and stuff.
Before we get into British Invasion.
They wouldn't let me near the building.
I'm sure. I'm sure you were banned. Before we get into Peter and
but
Gordon.
But I've been to a couple of meetings and they're pretty weird.
Really?
I've been to like two in my whole life.
Now, are a lot of the people in Mensa a little bit on the crazy side?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So in what way? What? Are they just like out there? Like they can't?
No, it's just a bunch of people. But, you know, I'm not sure I don't really know what it's for or what you'd expect. You know, they're all going to get together and solve the world's problems in 10 minutes over dinner. But no, it's IQ, as we all know, measures a particular kind of thinking ability.
Sure.
It may or may not be any use.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
been for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Now back to Gilbert and Frank. It's them that you soon will thank.
Gilbert found this interesting, too. We want to get into the British invasion, too. There's so much to cover with someone like you, Peter. But also, you were a child actor.
I was.
You worked with one of Gilbert's favorites, Alistair Sim.
I did. We were in a film called Escapade together.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it was a good film, actually. I saw it not long ago. They had a revival of it in L.A. They were talking about some particular period of British filmmaking. I can't remember what they called it. And some film research body was doing the screening, and they figured out I was not dead, and you know, I was the only person in the film left. You know, so they said,
right,
will you come and talk about making the movie? I said, yeah, of course.
And you worked with Claudette Colbert.
I did. Claudette Colbert played my mother.
Wow.
I got a great picture of me kissing Claudette Colbert very vigorously.
How about that, Gil? It happened one night.
And you worked with this actor, Jack Hawkins.
Yes.
Sure.
He was my father in the same film that Claudette Colbert played my mother. We were in the outposts of Malaya fighting the commies on behalf of the British Empire. In the film, we won. In real life, not so much.
I was just saying, like, years ago, I was watching a talk show, and Jack Hawkins had just had his vocal cords removed.
Yes, he did quite a few films after that. I mean, even with some lines that he would do with the, you know, buzzy thing, which they're getting better anyway. But
And I it seemed like he was talking about it, and the way some people burp the alphabet.
Yes.
He would burp the words.
Yes, that's what. Yeah, there's two ways they do it. Either they swallow the air and kind of talk over the burp, or they use those buzzy things like electric razors. But he got really good at it and could actually, you know, he was actually in a couple of films where he had short lines and he would get away with it.
I'm just curious about.
He was a terrific actor and a very nice man.
Terrific actor, Jack Hawkins. Yeah.
And then I did a film with Cecil Parker. I don't know if you remember. One of my favorite British actors.
Don't know that name.
Oh, look him up. You'll
know
him.
Okay, Cecil Parker.
He's in everything.
I know Cecil Kellaway.
look up Cecil Parker.
Okay.
He's in everything.
Okay. How did you and Jane get into acting in the first place? I mean, your dad was a physician. Your mom was a musician.
It's odd. The stories I'm told, I can't really remember, but apparently some agent or somebody spotted the three of us. I've got two sisters, Jane and Claire. We all have red hair. So it was like, and we were all graded by height and looked evidently, you know, cute or whatever. And so somebody said, oh, you know, you make some money out of those kids, you know.
Get them working.
And anyway, so some agent expressed interest, and we went, yeah, sure, you know. And we never did do anything, all three of us together. Jane and I did do one thing together. Because I did a number of the old Robin Hood series, if you remember
right.
that, with Richard Green, and the black and white, which is a very interesting story, by the way. That's another thing we could talk about for hours, but it was all created by Blacklist Americans who'd gone to England to find work. Hannah Weinstein put the thing together. It was the first episodic TV ever made in Britain. She would do a show a week.
Blacklisted writers who had to go overseas.
Largely blacklisted writers
that
went overseas. Anyway, I was Prince Arthur in a number of those episodes. But then later, after Prince Arthur had disappeared for a while, I came back as a peasant child with Jane as my sister. We were two peasant children trying to free their oppressed father from the clutches of the Sheriff of Nottingham. That's the only thing we ever did together. But you can find it. It exists.
I didn't know it was. I know the series, but I didn't know there were blacklisted American writers behind it.
Hannah Weinstein's the producer. And I don't think she's related to the Weinsteins as we know them. But she was a blacklisted producer, a left-wing Jewish producer from L.A. who'd gone to London to work.
How about that, Gil?
Wow.
Along with a lot of cool writers who went there, too.
So all of them, the whole crew was basically blacklisted.
No, the crew probably
not
was.
Not the crew.
I mean, I'm sure the union crew had to be
creators.
English.
But
I think the creators, as I understand
writers.
It, certainly Hannah Weinstein was the key figure, and they used some blacklisted writers as well to write episodes.
I got to dig into that.
Yeah.
So how did music, you're always musical, it was a musical family, but you obviously decided at some point not acting.
Yes, I'd like to think I made that decision, but it could be that the acting community made that decision.
Well, we'll give you credit for it.
No, I mean, by the time I got to school, see, Jane quit school when she was about 15. She knew acting was for her and she didn't need school and, she, you know. So, but I went to Westminster, which is a serious what, you know, what in England we call a public school, which isn't really public at all, expensive and hard to get into. And it was a very serious school in the middle, founded by Queen Elizabeth I and all that stuff. And so they would never give you time off to go and be in a film or anything. So it, so between that and the fact that I probably wasn't getting as much work as I was, I just started taking school seriously. And I could combine school and music, but not school and acting.
And at the risk of getting the wrath of Beatles fans the world over, you introduced John Lennon to Yoko Ono.
I was responsible for that meeting. I started a bookshop and an art gallery with some friends, two friends of mine, Barry Miles and John Dunbar. And Miles ran the bookshop, John ran the art gallery, and I was the third partner, and also put some of the money I thought I was making in pop music, turned out it wasn't really, but that's another story, into the bookshop and the art gallery called Indica. Named, of course, after the plant, cannabis indica. Maybe some botanists and
that tells us a lot.
Yes, exactly. And so we were trying to be like the City Lights bookshop or something. It was, you know, it was effective. We, you know, William Burroughs came over and did a reading. Ginsberg did a reading. Yeah. There it became the,
saw that
the,
in the research.
The spot. And then we opened this art gallery, and John had heard about this Japanese American artist who we thought sounded wacky enough to be in our cool avant garde gallery. So John got hold of her and asked if she'd come and do an exhibition. She said yes. We took an ad in the paper, and she came over and everything. And the way these things work, you'd have an opening night for the press and everything with wine and cheese or whatever. But we sometimes had a pre-press opening that we would invite friends to. And by this point, the Beatles were amongst my friends. So we invited everybody, and one of them came, and that was John. So that's where he and Yoko met.
And a lot of people have this very easy answer, that it was Yoko who split up the Beatles.
What's... No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, they were arguing about a lot of different things, and, you know, I think, yes, some of them got annoyed about Yoko, but in the end, it was Alan Klein that they were arguing about, you know, when they'd agreed that they wanted some serious businessman to come in and rethink the whole thing, because by then it had expanded into numerous areas beyond music. Apple Records was one thing, but it was films and electronics and clothes and this, that, and it was going a bit nuts. They just couldn't agree on who that person should be. And John was determined that it should be Alan Klein. And I think he was mistaken. I knew about Alan from New York, and I knew him essentially to be kind of a crook, you know. Turned out to be true. and so Paul was vehemently against Alan. Alan Klein somehow talked John into it the way these people do. Maybe he told John he was going to make Apple great again or something. I don't know. Whatever it took. But whatever, however these crooks talk us into electing them. But it didn't work, you know. And anyway, that was what I think. If one thing brought Paul and John to a point of departure from each other, that was it.
And you were at Apple then, so you were in the middle of some of those arguments.
The minute they chose Klein, I resigned.
Right.
So by the time John arrived, I had left.
And took James Taylor with you.
By the time Alan arrived, I had left.
And the relationship between Yoko and John, how did that, your opinion?
I wasn't there that much of the time. I mean, it was very close. He valued her opinion on everything, and she's a very smart woman. She's an eccentric woman, but a brilliant woman. And I think the Beatles were just new to them, because the rest of them had, you know, wives or girlfriends. They would leave and go to work, and Yoko was part of John's light partnership in everything. And I think they found that disconcerting. But, I mean, no, she and John loved each other very dearly, no question about that. But I wasn't there enough to comment beyond that.
Let's talk about Peter and Gordon and meeting Gordon. You met Gordon at Westminster
School? Met Gordon at school, yes. Essentially, we were both, you know, we were the only people we ran into who also played the guitar. By this time, I'd got a guitar. I played various instruments badly. I'd never kept up with my piano lessons or anything. I'm musically. Both my sisters are much better musically than I am. They both read music much better than I do, which is probably why I'm the only one making a living in the music business.
That's ironic.
But eventually I got a guitar, and I had a skiffle group like we all did. That's all other program.
Lonnie Donegan.
The skiffle movement, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Lonnie Donegan was great.
We talked to Billy J. Kramer about that very thing.
Yeah, he was such a big deal.
Yeah.
And most Americans don't get it. Jack White is a huge Lonnie Donegan fan. There are a few outposts of Lonnie Donegan fandom.
What was the song?
Does
Your Chewing Gum?
Well, the good one was Rock Island Life.
Rock, right, that's right.
And the bad one was Chewing
Gum. That was the novelty one that we got in the States.
Loses favorite. Well, no, Rock Island Life was number one.
What? Yeah.
Which is a Leadbelly song. And then does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight was also, sadly.
I guess I was a child, so that's the one that I remember.
Right. So Gordon played the guitar and sang as well. And so we tried doing it together, just really because we were there, you know. And it sounded okay. We'd work up some songs. And he was a bit more of a rock and roll. He was a big Eddie Cochran fan, big Elvis fan.
You were more the folky.
I was a bit more folky. And we were sort of a folky-ish duo. But where we our taste totally overlapped was the Everly Brothers, like all duos throughout history.
Right.
Whether it's Simon and Garfunkel or John and Paul or us, the Everly Brothers were our inspiration.
Everybody wanted to be the Everly Brothers.
Everybody wanted to be the Everly Brothers. We did. Yeah.
You were both big fans of American pop music.
Yep, for sure. I mean, again, this is a big subject because it goes beyond pop music. What you got to understand is we were big fans of America. I mean, when we grew up in, you know, people often ask me why the 60s were special in England and why it was different. And the answer is in the 50s, because the 50s in Britain and America could not have been more different. 50s in England were black and white, bomb sites, depressing. We still had rationing until 1956, you know, and we'd look across the Atlantic, and there was this miraculous land. As well, you know, if we were black and white, they were Technicolor and glossy and perfect teeth and huge refrigerators full of exotic foods and these silly cars with giant fins on them. And
you had a poster of the New York skyline.
I did. I had a poster of the New York skyline on my wall. I had copies of Downbeat with the jazz clubs I'd go to the minute I got to New York. I knew I would.
You couldn't wait to go.
I didn't know how. And going back and forth then was a very big deal. Now people go for a week's holiday in Florida like there's nothing to it. It's cheap tickets, and then it was a very big, very expensive deal. And on top of all that, you know, America, we could see, was taking over. This whole British Empire thing was, you know, which was people were still on about in England. It was clearly not happening anymore. You know, there was clearly to all of us that was yesterday, and tomorrow was America. And on top of that, to clinch it, all these American cities that we knew about from movies and television, New York and L.A. and New Orleans, and they all had amazing music, which we loved, you know. So we were obsessed with American music.
So it wasn't just the Everlys. You were listening to Little Richard.
Oh, no.
You were listening to Fats Domino. You were listening to anything you can get your hands on.
Of course. And we all were. And, I mean, the Beatles were a cover band.
Of course.
You know, that's how they began. They were doing all American songs. I used to go and see, R&B was huge. I used to go and see the Rolling Stones every Monday night. They were playing at a place called Studio 51, which was a R&B night on Mondays. It was Ken Collier's Jazz Club the rest of the week. And they, you know, they were playing all, you know, in their case, it would be like Bo Diddley and Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters. But nobody was playing their own songs. It was all a tribute to American music.
Right. And so Peter and Gordon, when you guys formed, that winds up becoming your ticket to America.
We did a bunch of R&B stuff, and we did folk stuff, and we did Everly stuff. Yes, exactly.
Right.
And that's what got us signed. You know, we were spotted in playing in a club by an A&R guy and signed up.
And they were, you said in an interview that everybody would confuse every single one of the English groups and duos together.
Well, you guys were confused with Chad and Jeremy?
Duos, particularly. Chad and Jeremy, which was kind of weird, really. we knew each other, you know. And we actually took over one gig from them. They were playing one bar, and they were leaving to go play somewhere else as a residency. And the bar asked them if they could recommend someone else, and they recommended us. So we helped each other out. But it was kind of odd because the two duos, in both cases, the tall, handsome one sang the low part, the short, nerdy one with glasses sang the high part. And what would happen is they did things that we didn't do. They did like the Patty Duke show. They were on Batman.
Oh, sure. Because the Dick Van Dyke show.
And the Dick Van Dyke show.
Right.
And people would congratulate us, but they were never on Ed Sullivan, and we were.
That's great.
But so what happened is, you know, we would do Ed Sullivan. People would congratulate them, and you kind of go, you know.
And that was the one where they had so many mobs of people chasing them, and they had to stay with the Petrie family.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that's it. Yes.
Yeah,
and they were playing another mythical English duo with different names.
I believe so.
Like Rodney and
they weren't even Chad and Jeremy.
No, they were.
Which makes no sense.
Exactly.
At all, looking back.
Well, Jeremy's still a very successful actor.
Yes.
He's in a play in London.
Yeah, we were talking to Billy Jay about it.
As is Jane, by the way. My sister's in the London version of An American in Paris.
Oh, cool.
Which is great. With the original guy from here, you know, the lead guy, whatever his name is.
His name is escaping.
Amazing
me.
And brilliant. And Jane plays Madame somebody or other.
And after those years of the New York skyline, Tell us what the experience was when you finally got to New York.
It was brilliant. I mean, it was astounding. One of our first gigs was playing the World's Fair. The what's the sphere thing called?
Oh, the Unisphere.
Unisphere.
You played the 64 World's Fair?
We did.
That's cool.
That was one of our very first gigs. And first of all, just arriving in New York, and the fact we knew exactly what it was going to look like. And it did, you know. It really looked
lived up to expectation.
And then, of course, to arrive and be chased around the city by teenage girls trying to tear your clothes off can only improve the experience. You know, it's the only way to travel. I recommend it highly. Should the opportunity ever come your way.
We wouldn't know.
And we played the Unisphere. They had a sort of a moat thing filled with water between us and the audience. And, of course, the minute we came on, they all jumped in the water and swam across. So it was like a wet T-shirt contest.
Wonderful.
It was all very exciting.
So you enjoyed your career over the years.
I did. I enjoyed every moment.
You lived every minute of the British invasion experience fantasy out.
Absolutely,
that's
yes.
great. Well, so
I continue to enjoy it, by the way.
So how did World Without Love happen? That was obviously a game changer.
It was. Well, what had happened was, you know, we got signed up by this guy, Norman Newell, who I think was thinking of as a kind of a folk duo. I think we were kind of like Britain's answer to the Kingston Trio, the Kingston Duo, as it were.
Interesting.
Or Peter and Paul Without Mary. So, because that's, it was a song, we did a version of 500 Miles that he particularly right. liked and so on. So he said, we auditioned, they signed us, but they said, we're doing 500 Miles, we're doing this, we're doing that. I'm going to go look for a couple of songs, but if you know any other songs, you know, you'd like to put on the list, let me know. Now, cut to, a few months before that, I'd heard this song, World Without Love, that Paul had written. And I said, that's a really good song. And he said, yeah, but I'm putting it aside. I'm not finishing it. We're not going to do it. It's John doesn't think much of it, and you know, I'm abandoning it for now. And apparently John really didn't like it. And I've read later, didn't witness this, but I've read later that John would actually interrupt Paul when Paul would start to try and sell him the song, because the first line is, please lock me away. And John would go, okay, I will. The song's over. So when Norman said, do you know any other songs, I kind of went, maybe I do. And I went back to Paul at home that very evening and said, is that song, World Without Love, still an orphan? And he said, yes, we're not doing it. I said, well, can we try and work up a harmony version of it, because it's pretty cool? And he said, yes, happily. So by this time it had only had the two verses but no bridge. So he wrote out the two verses for me on a piece of paper, which you'd better believe is safely locked in my safe.
I saw that you still have that.
Oh, yeah. So but the minute the music business collapses completely, I can run to Sotheby's as fast as my legs.
I would.
As fast as my legs can carry me.
I would.
But anyway, and he made a demo on my reel-to-reel tape machine. And then before the session came around, I had to nag him a little bit to write the bridge. So I wait, and in a while, bit... which he did, and it went on the list, and we recorded it that very first day. And by the end of the session, there was no doubt in anyone's mind that was going to be our single. We weren't folkies. We were going to be pop stars. And it came out only a month later and went to number one in the UK, number one in all over Europe, and eventually, to our disbelief and incredulity, number one in America. In fact, it was the first British invasion number one in America after the Beatles. After I Want to Hold Your Hand stopped being number one, we went up there, which is insanely great. The only snag for me was by that time I'd left Westminster. Gordon was still there because he's a year younger. I was at university doing philosophy. And in England, you know, they don't let you leave and come back. We don't have these mysterious credits that you have over here.
Right.
You're supposed to just start, you know, get your degree. And so I had to go and meet with the head of the philosophy department and explain this problem. And finally, I convinced him this was a completely unique opportunity, and he gave me a one-year leave of absence to go and get all this rock and roll nonsense out of my system and come back and get my degree. And tragically, of course, I have to admit to my shame that I'm still on that one-year's leave of absence.
Well, you had bigger fish to fry.
Well, yes, exactly. Yes, exactly.
I have to absorb certain things here. You're the first human being to hear I Want to Hold Your Hand, and you have songs being just handed over to you by Paul McCartney and John Lennon.
It's true. It's true. It was a leftover song. But what's interesting is because people go, well, how did you get all those other songs? And we didn't do any getting at all. They took songwriting seriously. I mean, if you read any interviews with the Beatles back then, one of the questions we all got asked is, what are you going to do when this is all over? because the assumption was, confident assumption, that 2 years was the max for a pop career. And they would always say, we will be songwriters. Because they didn't just want to be Eddie Cochran and Elvis and Buddy Holly. They wanted to be Lieber and Stoller.
Oh, and Bacharach and David.
Bacharach and David.
Wow.
Pomus and Schumann.
Sure.
They knew that. They looked upon it as the sort of a separate career. And songwriters, I mean, if you have a big hit single, you make damn sure you write the follow-up. You don't want somebody else cashing in on, you know, on your success. So when we came back from our first trip to America promoting Well Without Love, the second single, Nobody I Know, was written with a bridge, you know.
Waiting for done, you.
Waiting for us. So we didn't have to do any begging. You know, that's what songwriters do. They give you the songs you need.
What's the moment like, and there are only so many people on the planet that could answer this question, the moment that you find out that you have the number one record in the country?
Well, it's insane. And number one in England was insane. Number one in America meant more to us. And it's the same when the Beatles got the same phone call 6 months earlier or whatever it was, that I Want to Hold Your Hand was number one, because they knew they would get to go there, and that's what we knew. And it was, it meant we were going to
America.
It was
a phone call? The news came to you in a phone call?
Yes. Came in a phone call. And, you know, that was like the irrevocable proof that we were going to get to go to this land that we dreamed of going to. And we did.
You know, it's funny to think, because you told us about how the English had this dream world view of America. And when the English invasion was starting, America looked at everyone coming from there thinking, oh, this is the hip spot.
I know. Isn't that weird? And you know, as I say, that's what people ask, why were the 60s so cool? And it was a reaction. You know, it was a reaction to the bleakness of the 50s. Because, you know, everyone crowned a new queen and said it's a new Elizabethan age and blah, blah, blah. But eventually it wasn't until the young people kind of went, we're going to screw all this. You know, everyone in the 50s tried to dress like a grown-up. You know, that you tried to look older than you were. And suddenly everyone went, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to wear a suit like my dad. I'm going to wear these absurdly silly clothes and velvet and flowers and bell bottoms. And, you know, and it changed everything. And then America fell in love with, I mean, America was doing it too with the whole hippie thing. But
sure,
there was something radical that happened in England, which was a distinct reaction to the bleakness of the 50s. And there was a reaction to the 50s in America too, because they were a bit conventional and sturdy. But they weren't miserable like they were in England, you know.
Are you feeling brave, Peter?
I think so, yes.
We're talking about World Without Love,
yes,
and he's been excited about this. He sang Wichita Lineman with Jimmy, and Jimmy.
So I'm told. I didn't consult with Jimmy before I came.
You should have.
I probably should have.
Perhaps you should have.
Jimmy is a good friend, and I'm a huge fan.
He's the best.
But that's one thing I failed to do. Is though, should I let him sing with me?
Well, we always ask.
All right, I'm gonna have to carry you through this.
Yes, exactly. Don't worry, we'll do it.
Okay,
you follow
Gil.
The script, and I'll join you.
Follow his lead.
Okay. Okay. You follow the script. Okay.
Here we go.
Please lock me away, and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
Birds sing out of tune, and rain clouds hide the moon. I'm okay, here I'll stay with my loneliness.
I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
So I wait, and in a while I will see my true love smile. She may come, I know not when. When she does, I lose. So baby, until then, lock me away, and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
Second bridge, second Gilbert.
So I wait, and in a while I will see my true love smile. She may come, I know not when. When she does, I lose. So baby, until then, lock me away. And don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
One repeat.
I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love.
And an instrumental.
Brilliant.
Peter and Gilbert.
Who needs Gordon? Brilliant.
Peter and Gilbert, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. That was fun.
Birds are not the only ones singing out of tune.
Oh, yeah.
And the interesting thing is, there's these weird lyrics float around, which, when she does, I lose, which came from God knows where. It's on the web in places, but it's wrong. It's when she does, I'll know.
Oh, wow. I apologize for that.
No, it's quite all right. But yeah. Every now and then you look up the lyrics and it says lose. But if you listen, we're definitely saying no. And he wrote no.
Strange.
I have the handwritten manuscript to prove it. When she does, I'll know. So but when she does, I'll lose.
Right.
That's kind of insulting.
When she finally
turns up, you go, uh-oh.
I'll start proofreading the lyrics going forward. Here's another thing I like about Paul living in your house is your dad had arranged for an escape route for him.
Yeah, my father found a way over into a neighbor's house on the roofs so that Paul could escape, because of course it became known eventually that he was there. The weirdest part, of course, must have been for, you know, because his house was in Wimpole Street, you know, which is that whole Wimpole Street, Harley Street medical zone. So my father saw patients there too. It was his consulting rooms as well as our house. So he would have patients come and there'd be like a crowd of girls on the doorstep. We never explained.
Completely bewildered.
He's the only doctor in England with groupies, you know.
Now, a strange thing in your life that reminds me of a movie I saw.
What's that?
Yep. Oh, you were the best man at the wedding for Marianne Faithfull.
I was, yes.
Now, Marianne Faithfull did a strange movie.
Girl on a Motorcycle?
It was Irina Palm.
Ah,
okay.
Where she's a grandmother.
Oh, this was more recently?
Yes.
Not young, beautiful Marianne.
Oh, no.
Old,
this is old, the
cool old Marianne.
Yes.
She's great. I love Marianne. Anyway, no, I don't remember that. I haven't seen it.
She's a grandmother who's retired and, you know, struggling for money and has a handicapped son. And the movie is how she just falls into a job where guys go to a place, put their dicks through a hole in the wall, and Marianne Faithfull on the other side jerks them off.
Where on earth did you see this?
This is a movie. It's actually not a bad film.
Well, there you go. I wasn't aware of that.
That's a showstopper.
That's very good.
And it wasn't like a sex comedy or anything.
How
it was
strange.
Like very serious.
I have to research that.
Yes. Yeah. And I have not seen it. I could bring it out with Marianne, I suppose. Yeah.
Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I wouldn't. Tell us about part of the experiences you just mentioned, playing the Sullivan Show. And what was that like?
It was great. I mean, it was I'll tell you an interesting story, though. The reason we weren't on the Sullivan Show when we first got here was indirectly Alan Klein again.
Uh-oh.
And I'll tell you why. Not being evil, but actually being clever. He had set up a system whereby when all the new English singles came out, he would have them shipped immediately that week, the new hot releases, straight over to New York. And occasionally he would cover them on his label, Cameo Parkway. And Bobby Rydell did a cover of World Without Love the minute it did come out in the UK, before ours came out in America. He put his out, went in the charts. And then when ours came out, we luckily knocked him out of the charts. And ours became the hit. But meanwhile, when we got here and our agent tried to get us on Ed Sullivan, they were going, fine. But then they said, we're going to sing World Without Love. He went, no, you can't do that. Bobby did that song last week. So,
oh, bad timing.
Because he was a regular on the Sullivan Show.
Right.
So we didn't get on Sullivan till later with another McCartney song called I Don't Want to See You Again.
Right.
But that was why we weren't on, was that...
What was Ed like to
you didn't meet him.
Sullivan.
It was Mr. Sullivan, and you didn't really meet him. But what they did tell you, when you finish and bow, look over at Mr. Sullivan, And if he puts his arm out, you walk over and shake his hand. But if he doesn't, you don't. But he did, of course, or I wouldn't be telling the story.
From England, the two London youngsters who met while they were attending Westminster School and developed into top flight stars, ladies and gentlemen, Peter and Gordon.
How can I understand when someone says to me, I don't want to see you again? Why I cry at night, something wrong could be right. I hear you say to me, I don't want to see you again.
As you turn your back on me, you hear the light.
I didn't have to play broken hearted. That later on, after love's been and gone, I'll still hear someone say, I don't want to see you again.
As you turn your back on me, you hit the light of day.
I didn't have to play when someone says to me, I don't want to see you again. I don't want to see you again. I don't want to see you again.
I'll tell you one person that was a bit of a surprise. Was when our agent got all excited when they said that they'd got us on the Jackie Gleason show. And we'd never heard of him
because we I love that
we got very few we got Sergeant Bilko, that was about the only American TV we loved Phil Silvers. We didn't get the Honeymooners, so we had no idea. And everyone's going, oh, Jackie Gleason, this is amazing, you know, so cool, you're on his show. So we were quite excited. He was this legendary guy. So we went. This is when he had a variety show down in Miami.
Sure.
After the Honeymooners, but they would do a bit
Jackie
of
Jackie Gleason show.
They did a bit of Honeymooners in the middle.
That's right.
So we went down there, you know, and walk on the set, and there's this obnoxious, drunken asshole of a man being really horrible to everyone. Not to us. He didn't even speak to us. But the crew, the cast, we were kind of like, this guy's a complete shit, you know. And that, of course, was the immortal Jackie Gleason.
Oh, no! The great one.
Since then, The Honeymooners, learned it all by heart. I recognize he was a complete genius and had every right to be as assholish as he wished. But he certainly was using that right to the fullest on
amazing.
This particular occasion. But then we did Red Skelton, and he, on the other hand, was not drunk and not unpleasant at all. He was very nice.
Did you do Milty's show, too?
No, we never did.
Oh, okay.
That saves the question.
Red Skelton. You know, the internet cannot be trusted in certain respects.
Well,
They have you guys playing the Burl show.
Maybe we did.
Yeah.
We did a few. I don't remember meeting him, but I don't remember. Maybe we did.
All right.
Who knows?
So Peter and Gordon.
If it's on the internet, it must be true.
I do. This must be true. I also want to ask you about one other hit. I want to ask you about "I Go to Pieces," written by the great Dale Shannon.
Dale Shannon, yes.
Yeah. What was he like? I mean, he was a great talent who came to a sad
very
end.
Nice. I mean, that was another one we sort of picked up off the floor in a way, because we were on tour with The Searchers, another great English band, and Dale Shannon. And he'd written this song that he thought would be right for The Searchers. And inexplicably, and to my mind mistakenly, they turned it down. They said, thank you very much. I don't think it's right for us. They actually could have made a good record of it. But we'd overheard it and kind of went, oh, well, if they're not doing it, can we have it? And we worked out a version and said, look, you know, hold that song. We'll cut it as soon as we get back to England. And we did.
Great track. And so when Peter and Gordon finally split up in 1968, you decide to go in different directions.
Well, the interesting thing is we didn't actually split up.
You didn't officially split up.
No, I mean, we never said this is our last gig. We never had a big row. We never had an Everly Brothers punch up on stage or anything, you know. We just drifted into a kind of hiatus. And I confess that when the hiatus went on for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, my assumption was. we're not going to do some more. But of course we did. Gordon and I got back together after 38 years.
Thanks to Paul Schaefer.
Thanks to Paul Schaefer. But to go back to where you were, where were you again? Oh, yes. That's when I went off and did other things. I decided
different paths.
I wanted to be a record producer. I knew that.
Right.
I loved the process of making records from the day we first went in the studio. And so I did. And that's a career I deliberately went after.
Mm-hmm. And you were sort of like at one point not as excited about performing as you were about being in the creative process.
Yes. Well, performing then was very different, too. I mean, we had fun. We had a great time. But it's like, you know, you probably saw it 8 days a week. And when the Beatles...
It's great, by the way.
Yeah, it's terrific.
I recommend it.
Oh, yeah, terrific. Ron Howard's a great friend and a brilliant filmmaker. You couldn't hear yourself. They couldn't hear you, really. Sure. I mean, it was an experience. But music now, it's great. You know, the technology's changed everything.
People forget they were singing through the PA system when they would play arenas in those
days. Monitors didn't exist.
Yeah.
The word monitor didn't exist. There were jobs that we have now that didn't exist. Front of house mixer didn't exist. Guitar tech didn't exist. I mean, no, all that stuff. And monitor mixer, no monitors. You were using whatever PA was in the building, including like the same thing they announced the score over was what you sang.
So when they play Candlestick Park, that's what they're singing.
It's crazy. Yeah. And then you just had big amps on stage. Nothing was mic'd except the vocals. It was crazy. So you couldn't hear yourself. You couldn't hear anything. They couldn't hear you. It was kind of annoying. And I loved the studio, you know, completely. So I decided I wanted to, and then got lucky enough to find an artist I believed in. That's when I became a manager as well.
And you said that in an interview that how much it's changed being on the road.
Completely, yes.
What are the changes?
Well, as I say, some of it is the technology. Some of it's the fact that it's organized now. It was chaotic then. I mean, everyone was making it up as they went along. I mean, there are aspects of it that have maybe become too corporate and too organized on a grand scale, you know, with crazy $300 ticket prices and, you know, all that stuff. It's just got very elaborate now. But, you know, so there's a certain homemadeness that one misses, but there's no question that when you go to a show now, you expect to be able to hear everything and see everything and get a real production, and you do.
Sure.
And it's great and it's exciting, you know, so it's changed radically.
It's stunning to think that this
even on our level, even when I play clubs, you know, I still go out and I do a memoir show thing with a band,
right?
And then I've lately been doing a bunch of gigs with Albert Lee, a genius guitar player.
Absolutely,
singer, you know,
who
played with the Everly Brothers, my brothers, and Emmylou Harris for years and all that stuff. But even for us, it's completely different. I mean, we can hear ourselves; the audience can hear everything perfectly. You know, you can really make a show sound good. Your guitars sound like real guitars, and back then there was none of that existed.
And I think the Beatles were getting tired of that, not being able to hear themselves.
Completely. I mean, Ringo says it was only by watching their behinds, their whole backs and movement, that he knew what song they were doing.
Right.
I mean,
a combination of bad tech and screaming.
Yeah, exactly.
A
combination
fans.
Of bad tech and screaming fans.
Right.
I mean, that scene in 8 Days a Week when Ringo comes out and he's trying to stop the drum riser falling over before he climbs on it.
It's fascinating.
It's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember we had one guy on the road, you know, doing everything. And I was kind of, when we toured with the Beatles, I went, well, this will be different. They had two, you know. But now a band like the Beatles would have 100, you know,
of course,
people and semis and, you know, the change is beyond measure.
So you went your separate ways. Paul asked you to take a job at Apple.
Yes.
And you went into A&R.
Yep.
And you were scouting talent.
He started off saying, would you produce some records for Apple? Because he was aware of my production work. Indeed,
sure.
He played on a couple of things that I had produced. So he'd watched me at work. And I said yes. And then he said, well, why don't you be head of A&R for the label? And jumped at it. Yes.
And Mr. Taylor
and Mr.
came
Taylor
into your life.
Came into my life.
Danny Kortchmar?
Yes. Danny Kortchmar had been in a... You know, we used to get assigned a band to back us up on different legs of a tour in America. I mean, admittedly, you only had to work up 20 minutes of songs, but the bands varied a great deal in quality. But Danny was in a good band called the King Bees, and they backed us up on two tours, I think, and Danny and I became great friends in that time. Then he was subsequently, some years later, in this band, The Flying Machine, with his childhood friend, James Taylor. They'd grown up on the Vineyard together, So that band was in New York and having a hard time, and a couple of them were strung out and broke and this, that, and the other. And the band broke up, and James decided he would go to London. He had a girlfriend he thought he could stay with in London. And Danny gave him my phone number, just said, you know, here's a friend of mine in London. If you're going to be there, give him a call. So he called me up out of the blue and came over.
And what did you hear? Which song?
Something in the Way She Moves. Something's Wrong. Knocking Around the Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Not Caroline in My Mind. He wrote that a few months later. That was probably Soak Around the Sun. Not sure what else.
But you knew. You knew straight away.
I was knocked out. I mean, everything. I mean, he had played the guitar brilliantly, this finger-picking style that obviously owed something to classical playing. He'd been listening to Segovia and Julian Bream and stuff and not just, you know, folkies. But then he was using these kind of jazzy Manhattan's Records kind of chords, but singing with this beautiful folky tenor. And, of course, in that era, the term singer-songwriter hadn't been invented. If you had long hair and played the guitar, you were a folk singer. Didn't matter if you never sang a folk song.
That's interesting.
If you wrote every song you played, you were still a folk singer. And that was what he was. But I'd never heard anything that good. And we had this strange conversation that really was kind of, I said, look, I've got this new job. I'm head of A&R for a new record label. Would you like a record deal? And he said, yes, I'd love one. And so within 2 days, I had him in the office meeting the Beatles and signing up.
And they responded too? Mm.
They loved it too. I played them Something the Way She Moves in particular, and they all agreed.
What's not to like?
What's not to like? And so we signed. He was the first artist signed to Apple.
And that gets us back to another subject we brought up on this show.
Which is?
Songs that mention other songs in them.
Well, I believe, and I hope this isn't bad information too, but that Something in the Way She Moves in some way inspired George.
Well, we have to assume so.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, George certainly heard it and liked it.
Right.
And then wrote a song with oddly similar lyrics. Yeah. But James, in response to that, when people say, well, how do you feel? You know, did George adopt your phrase? The answer is that in that song, James keeps putting in, I feel fine, which he said he'd thought of because of the Beatles.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's great stuff.
She's around me now and I feel fine.
When he says, holy host of others standing around me,
that's
too,
apparently
he's referring
Beatles.
To the Beatles.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yes.
That's been Caroline in my mind. Yes. That's pretty cool, too.
Yeah,
I just learned that.
He wrote that. It was after he'd met them. We'd signed to Apple. He went away for a week or two of holiday to Ibiza, and that's where he wrote Carolina.
It's great. I'll tell you, I've seen interviews and listened to interviews with James Taylor recently.
Yeah.
He gives you a lot of credit for being the person that believed in him.
I did. I mean, because essentially when we moved to America, neither of us had any money. I was betting my career on his. I dropped him off on the East Coast for a bit of rehab he was in the mood for at the time, and I then went out to California and made a record deal.
And you're looking back at those people, I mean, the people that you assembled, I mean, Danny, Randy Meisner, Carole King, Russ Kunkel.
No, hold on. That's not the Apple album.
No, I mean later on.
Oh, the Sweet Baby James.
Yeah, Sweet Baby James.
Yeah. They were very distinct because the Apple album was just people in London. So, you know, Paul played on it. But other than that, we had to put a little band together of English musicians.
Right, I jumped. I split. I split when you went to L.A.
Right. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Sorry, but I thought you said, my mistake. But then when we got to L.A., I decided to make the album much simpler and I wanted to put a band together. By this time, I'd heard the demos Carole King had done of all the great songs she wrote, you know, the demo of, you know, Up on the Roof or whatever. And I loved her piano playing. So when Danny Kortchmar introduced me to Carole, I said, would you consider just being the pianist on this project I'm doing? And she came over to my house where James was staying and they met and sat down and played together. And Russ Kunkel had never been in the studio before. I heard him in a Jon Stewart rehearsal. Jon Stewart used to be in the Kingston Trio. I loved the way he played. He was the first person I'd heard who played. He hadn't been listening to Hal Blaine, but to Ringo, you know what I mean? A whole other kind of drum fill. And so I hired him to do those sessions.
And how did you find Linda Ronstadt?
I was in New York, and somebody said, you have to go and see this girl. I don't remember who it was. Have to go and see this girl playing at the Bitter End. She's amazing. She's got the greatest voice you ever heard in your life. She's brilliant and she's unbelievably beautiful and she sings barefoot and it was all true. And I went there and met her afterwards. And we didn't actually start working together right away because I just started working with Kate Taylor, James's sister, and I thought managing two women might be complicated. But in the end, Kate decided to take some time off and at that point, Linda and I got together and I started managing her and producing it. And the first album I produced with Linda, she'd done a couple of other ones, but I produced Heart Like a Wheel.
And the thing that eventually had her stop performing, Linda Ronstadt,
But she has Parkinson's.
Yeah. How's she doing, by the way?
She's, I mean, as well as anyone with a very unpleasant disease can be doing. She's,
of course.
She's fine, you know. She always worries about her brain, you know, because she goes, I feel my brain turning to Swiss cheese. But she's so brilliant. She's one of the most smartest women I've ever met. Incredibly well-read and
best girl singer you ever heard in your life, I've heard
she
you
is.
Say.
It's amazing that those two things would apply to the same person, but they do.
Yeah.
I mean, no reason they shouldn't, but it's, you know, very fortunate when someone's an amazingly good singer and is incredibly smart and well-read and fascinating. So I've treasure her as a singer and as a friend. But yes, so Parkinson stopped her singing and, you know, she can walk a bit and stuff, but it's a very annoying disease.
We're fans here. Yeah. And those albums.
She's the greatest.
Prisoner in Disguise, Heart Like a Wheel, I mean, Simple Dreams, Living in the USA, they're wonderful records.
Thank you very much.
And if our listeners, we have about 1 million people now a month listening to the show.
Wow.
If our listeners do not know these albums, by all means, run out and get them.
Absolutely.
And also the James Taylor record.
She's one of the greatest interpreters of songs because she's not a songwriter, you know, She herself, I mean, I didn't know about Warren Zevon until she came to me and said, we're going to do several songs about this brilliant guy. And she was right.
Well, all those songs.
The McGarrigle sisters, she rescued.
Elvis Costello, she does Allison.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
And then Elvis was incredibly rude about it, but she subsequently apologized.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, what? How was he rude about it?
Oh, because, he had to be. He was a punk. And so, he did a Rolling Stone interview when he kind of derided Linda's version as, you know, awful. Meanwhile, of course, but made him more money than he'd ever made in his life so far because it was a big hit.
Well,
but he did. I love Elvis very much. We've become friends, and he totally acknowledges that he was being a bit of a deliberate punk.
Well, also this,
in the musical sense.
That's funny. I'm glad he apologized. The songwriting, I mean, not just Zevon and Elvis Costello, but I mean that you guys were picking, you know, Stones covers, Orbison. Buddy
yes.
Holly, I mean, you went to the best places.
We did. I mean, Linda and I were fans of a lot of the same people, and so we did that. Yes, it was fun.
I love When I Grow Too Old to Dream, which on Living in the USA, I don't know which one of you decided to pick that one, but it is an absolutely
stunning song. I think that was Linda, I think. I'm not sure. Generally, I'm the one usually picking some of the rock and roll ones, because Linda would make an all slow album, given the choice. She likes singing slow songs. And of course, when we did the Nelson Riddle albums, which was completely her idea, not mine. I supported her in it, but I didn't think they would be successful. And of course, they did unbelievably well.
They're great records.
The first one sold 3 or 4 million, more than her preceding rock and roll albums. And working with Nelson was a thrill. I owe Linda a huge debt of gratitude for that.
My hat's off. Those records are wonderful.
And Elvis Costello, since then, of course, has become a hero of mine. He's one of the best songwriters in America.
Friend Jimmy Webb turns up twice.
And Jimmy Webb.
On Get Closer.
Yes, he does. And then we did that Cry Like a Rainstorm, Howl Like a Wind album. Where
That's right.
What, 3 Jimmy Webb tunes, I think. Adios and, gosh.
I know The Moon is the Heart's Mistress.
Moon is the Heart's Mistress. That's a great song.
Yeah.
No, Jimmy's amazing. There's nobody like
him.
Great
how
here.
Did you get involved with Robin Williams and Steve Martin?
Quite differently. Robin, I think I met through my wife, who knew Robin. My wife, Wendy, knew Robin before I did. And so we met and hit it off and became great friends, and we would hang out together a lot. And when he was talking about filming and recording the tour, I had some ideas about how we could make a record that would be a different thing than what the DVD of one show. You know, the DVD was the HBO show, essentially. But for the album, we recorded every show and took all the best bits. And he also would do different bits every night about the city he was in. So we had a separate CD with all those put together. So I was explaining to him what I thought he could do. And he said, you know, why don't you produce it and come with us on the road? And I said, yes, please. Robin and his wife, Marsha, who helped very much put that together.
How does one produce a comedy album?
Well, in this case, it really was a question of note taking primarily, remembering where all the best bits were.
You guys won a Grammy. You won Grammys.
We did. We won a Grammy.
Yeah.
We won best comedy album, not one I counted on winning.
And congratulations.
And then Steve Martin was different because Steve also is a friend, and I was having dinner with him here in New York, and he was telling me about this stuff that he was working out with Edie Brickell. He'd written some banjo melodies. He'd given them to her. She'd written these amazing songs kind of on top of them. He thought that she was just going to put lyrics to the banjo melody, instead of which she wrote a whole counter melody. It was brilliant. And I heard those over dinner at Steve's house. And again, we were talking about I said, you know, these are really good. You should make an album, and here's how I think you could do it. So it wasn't strictly a bluegrass album, but make it a little more adventurous than that. Put some other instruments in it and real strings and not just a fiddle. And so on. So, and the same thing kind of happened. I was actually on the plane home the next day that Steve emailed me on the plane and said, do you want to produce the record? And I said, yes. So basically, I'm always out hustling for work.
You are.
That's what it comes down to.
You're the busiest person we've ever had on the show. I was looking at your website.
I did those two Stephen Eady albums, and then, of course, they turned that into a Broadway show, Bright Star, which is a terrific show, which ran on Broadway for a while. Not long enough to officially be a hit, but we did 100 and some shows. So it was, and it's opening in L.A. This fall at the Arlington. And I was music supervisor for the show, and then I produced the cast album, which we were nominated for Tonys and Grammys and all that stuff, which was exciting. So
you have your hands in everything.
I work with Hans Zimmer a lot.
Yeah,
too.
You're doing movie music.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I like to keep busy. I'm not going to take up golf and move to Florida or anything in the future.
Just a couple of last questions, Peter. We know you got to go, and you've been such a sport.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And just filled with information. In addition to recommending those Ronstadt albums, I'm going to tell our listeners too to get those James Taylor albums for God's sake. I mean, they're wonderful. Gorilla, JT, In the Pocket, Walking Man, they're all wonderful. And everybody, you get to hear everybody on there. I mean, Paul and Linda McCartney show up. Art Garfunkel's on there.
Yep.
David Crosby, Graham Nash, everybody.
Yep. It's true. It's true. It's true. And I will also I will plug my shows with Albert, if I may.
Please do.
We're doing a bunch of shows with Albert Lee here on the West, on the East Coast, starting with The Cutting Room this Sunday. But do come if you can.
And Celebrity Biography.
And I'm doing the Celebrity Biography thing, which is
a great show.
Keeping my acting career going. because that's, you know, my acting career does every now and then pop up again. I did a film, I had a small role in a film called Doris and Bernard. I don't know if anybody saw it.
No, who's in that?
It was an HBO movie.
Okay.
My friend Bob Balaban.
Oh, yes.
Who I'm actually having dinner with tonight.
Oh.
Directed it. And there I am again, hustling for work. And,
yeah. And we're big fans of
and
this.
They did this great movie about Doris Duke. You know, Susan Sarandon played Doris Duke, and Ralph Fiennes played the butler, who has this peculiar, confusing relationship with her throughout the whole movie. In order for Ralph Fiennes to get the job, the old butler has to get fired. So I was the old butler in pages 1, 2, and 3, serving Susan Sarandon her watermelon at the wrong temperature for breakfast and getting fired.
Yeah, I was
so without me, Ralph Fiennes couldn't have got anywhere. So.
And you were in the Ruddles movie, I'd also like to point out.
I'm in the second Ruddles movie.
The second one.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Eric Idle's a dear friend and a genius.
And the great Neil Innes.
Yeah. Yes, and Neil Innes. Absolutely.
So we have to ask you this real quick.
Yeah.
Gil, you have anything else?
No.
We let this man get on with his life, and maybe he'll take us out. He'll be kind enough to take us out with a song. First of all, Faust, the Randy Newman project, is another masterpiece.
Oh,
so
thank you.
You have my
thank you. That was fun to
admiration.
Do.
My admiration.
That was fun to do. We had James Taylor.
Elton's on there.
Don Henley, Elton John, Linda Ronstadt, Bonnie Raitt.
Everybody, get
incredible.
That one, too.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So, and just the last thing, that's the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper, so we'd be remiss in not just asking you about it. I mean, even if it's just...
I remember visiting the studio a couple of times, so I'd heard little bits, but not much. I mean, I wasn't in the studio hardly at all. I mean, people... Oh, I think if everyone who says they were at a Beatles session was actually there, it would have been as big as the Albert Hall. But but what I did do was hear the whole thing when it was finished. I remember distinctly when Paul brought home a metal lacquer. You know, they just assembled it all and put it together for the first time and played it. It was just in our dining room at home on an ordinary old record player, you know, the kind with a lid. And it sounded amazing, just the mono lacquer straight from the studio, and I was blown away. And I realized that albums were never going to be the same.
Never going to be the
same.
They
were talking about that, I think, on PBS recently, the making of Sgt. Pepper.
There was a great special on PBS.
Yes.
Wonderful, with a musicologist.
Yes.
Who really takes you through the...
How impossible it was to do that then.
Yeah, because it was all four-track. I mean, the technology was fascinating. I could go on about that for hours, too. But, that's an issue. I've been working with Apple records, you know, that apple, quite a bit lately. Indeed, I also have a radio show now.
Tell us about that.
I have a radio show every Thursday night at 8 p.m. on the Sirius XM on the new Beatles channel. They gave me asked me if I could do an hour show once a week, and I get to play pretty much whatever I want because it's supposed to be Beatle related.
Right,
of course. Once you include everything that influenced the Beatles and everyone they influenced,
that's it's a wide net.
That's everybody.
Right.
So,
right,
so
right.
I try to like this, tell a story, a thread that goes through it all. And you know, include some cool music that people might not have heard.
And I heard
that's Thursday nights at 8.
Thursday
Eastern,
nights at 8. On what? Where can they get that?
SiriusXM.
SiriusXM
on the Beatles channel.
Okay, that's great. Now I'm going to listen to that for sure. Go ahead, Gil.
No, just heard that the Beatles they had like sort of a rivalry, creative rivalry with the Beach Boys.
Yes, they did. I mean, I think they both realized. I can't remember what the order is anymore, but was it Sgt. Pepper, then Pet Sounds, or the other
way around? I think Pet Sounds came out when the Beatles heard that.
Pet Sounds is first, but
yeah, maybe so. So yeah, they what one way or the other, you know, Pet Sounds maybe inspired Sgt. Pepper, and then these boys, you know. But I think it was definitely a case of somebody doing something brilliant, and their big rivals going, "Oh shit, you know, how are we going to beat that?" And so and it was an amiable musical competition.
Absolutely.
And just, you know, everyone trying to be better than everybody else, which is what show business is all about.
Because I think McCartney had heard Pet Sounds.
You could be right.
And he couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I don't remember that specifically as an experience of mine, but certainly I know that would took place, and we've all read about it.
And the last thing I want to ask you, and we'll get to the we'll throw the plugs in again at the end, but and you've been asked this before. Did you know that this music was going to have the permanence that it's had, the lasting effect that it's had? Was there any way to know?
No, I don't think. I didn't really think about it. I mean, as I say, the perception at the time was being a pop star is an extremely short, ephemeral career.
Because
nobody took the music seriously. The record company certainly didn't. I mean, EMI looked down their noses at it. You know, they took their classical music seriously
sure.
and their radar business seriously more than pop music. But no, and that's why, you know, when that the Times of London music critic wrote that... life-changing review of the Beatles where he took the music seriously and reviewed it as music and said it was brilliant. And that was kind of the beginning of a total change of attitude. And now classical musicians, jazz musicians, and rock and roll musicians are all thought of in their respective fields as equals. But before that, you know, the jazz guys and the classical guys looked down their noses at everything pop. I could do that if I wanted to, but of course they couldn't.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right.
They're each of them a very particular arts, and now pop music's given the respect it's due.
Great. We know you got to fly. Do you have time to do one more with him?
Sure.
Seventeen, a beauty queen. She made a ride that caused a scene. Her long blonde hair. Hanging down around her knees, all the cats who dig striptease, praying for a little breeze. Her long blonde hair falling down on her arms, hiding all the ladies' charms.
Hey, take it away. There you go.
Lady Godiva, she found fame and made her name. A Hollywood director came into town,
and said to her,
"How'd you like to be a star? You're a girl who could go far, especially dressed the way you are." She smiled at him, gave a pretty head a shake. That was Lady G's mistake.
Hey, take it away.
Lady Godiva.
He directs Certificate X. And people now are craning their necks to see her.
Cause she's a star. One that everybody knows. Finished with the striptease shows. Now she can't afford her clothes. Her long blonde hair is lying on the barber's floor. She doesn't need it anymore.
Hey, big long one for the end.
Lady Godiva.
now.
Terrific. Very good.
Peter, thank you.
Never sounded
so
better.
Much.
Thank you.
Oh, give us the plugs again.
You. If you look on peterashenmusic.com, there's a whole itinerary.
Where we'll send people.
Come to a show if you can. Because the nice thing about playing small places, I get to say hello to everyone afterwards and hang out and stuff. So do come and say hi.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to put up to the video that our friends have just been taking here. And we'll put it up on social media tonight just to get.
Absolutely. That should be deeply embarrassing. Yes.
So, I'm Gilbert Godfrey. This has been Gilbert Godfrey's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre. And we've been here talking to my fellow Mensa graduate, Peter Asher.
I doubt that. Peter, this was a treat.
Thank you very much.
You are someone we could talk to for 7 hours.
Oh, yes. I warned you. I can go on forever.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, pal.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is
mine. I tell my arms they'll hold someone new. Another love that will be true. But they don't listen. They don't seem to care. They reach for her, but she's not there. Inside.